shouldn't be a bumpy ride at all, I hope. Okay, so the topic of today's talk is syncretism, and I'm going to be looking at a particular instance of it. And what I always found intriguing and interesting in studying syncretism is what it can tell us about the underlying structure of meaning, about the meaning components out of which morphological and syntactic representations are built out of. And so just starting from a simple paradigm, like the one in English, where what we seem to see is that English in the pronominal domain and also in the nominal one makes a systematic distinction between the singular and plural, except for in the second person, where we find the pronoun you, both second person singular and plural. And this situation is referred to as syncretism, when you have two functions, two different meanings, but a single form. Okay. And what's been interesting to me to study about syncretism is because the hypothesis I'll be following is that it tells us something about the meaning composition of the categories which show syncretism. So in this particular case, it's relatively easy to see that the singular one, you, refers to an addressee, whereas the second plural refers to addressee and other persons. Okay. And there is a clear meaning overlap. So the bold-faced addressee meaning is shared by both expressions, and that is quite likely the reason for why we can have a single marker serving the two functions. Okay. So syncretism simply tells us something about the meaning overlap. And today I will look at the marking of datives, allatives, and locatives in the languages of the world, building on a typological study by Blunsett from the 80s. And I'll try to reason from the facts we find to the underlying structure of the categories. That is, the question will be, what are the elements of meaning that enter into the sort of buildup of the meaning of datives, allatives, and locatives, to the effect that we do find the syncretism fact that I'll be talking about shortly. And the second question that I'll address, that I'll be basically forced to address in order to explain the facts, is also a related model of lexical storage. Okay. So there is a traditional idea that when you have a marker like you, the pronoun, it actually in the lexicon, it's kind of specified for the bold-faced meaning, for the smallest or largest common denominator of the two environments where it appears. That is, the morpheme U in the lexicon means addressee. Okay, and that I will refer to as underspecification. Since it refers to the addressee, it can also be used to express the meaning of addressee plus someone else. Okay, it's underspecified. And that's been the tradition going at least 100 years back, maybe even more. There is an alternative approach, namely over-specification, which has not been pursued much, but the idea is the complete reverse, and apparently only a small notational variant of the previous version. Yet in the case we will look at, we will see that there's some important difference that this makes. So the over-specification alternative would sort of lead us to lexically store the pronoun you as specified both for the addressee and others. And since it can pronounce the two elements of meaning, it can also pronounce a subset of that specification. Okay, so these are the two logical approaches. And we will see what difference that makes when we look at the pattern that we actually want to explain in this particular talk. So, as said, I'll be looking at the marking of datives, allatives, and locatives, and I'll define them by their function. So, even though usually datives and allatives and locatives refer to more narrowly to case markers, I'll be basically looking at any marker, be that a free morpheme or a suffix or a prefix, whatever a particular language happens to have, that has a particular function, the recipient for the dative, goal of motion for the allative, and location or the place where for the locative. So if we look at a specific language, for example, like Basque, I'll always be presenting three examples. The top one is usually trying to use the verb to give for the recipient, for the dative. So I've given a gift to my father and mother, so I've got father with the ri, mother, also with Ri, so Ri is the dative marker. They called Javier to the office. So the idea here is that they did the calling. As a result, Javier has undergone a change of location from not being in the office to being in the office. So that's our allative marker Ra. And Pati sowed wheat in the field, that's the location, and we have the marker An. So there's no syncretism to speak of in Basque. And so what you see is that in general, there is no problem for languages to keep the three roles separate. Nevertheless, what we do find is that there are also syncretisms. So one or more of these grammatical roles are marked the same. And Blansit, back in 1988, has noticed that the functions, if you order them dative, allative, and locative, can be identically marked only if the identically marked functions are contiguous in the order as shown in 6. And so, for example, what you can find is that when all the markers are marked the same, so I'm denoting that by the shading, okay, the dative, the allative, and the locative have a single marker. So that's fine, we find it. We also do find languages where the dative and the allative are marked the same, the locative is different. We find languages where the allative and the locative are the same and the dative is different. What we do not find are languages where the dative and the locative are marked the same and the allative is different. Okay, so I'm going to give you some examples. It's an example from Japanese. Again, we have the give verb and the marker on the recipient is ni. The children went to two parks. We have the ni marker on park again, marking the allative function. Ginza is in Tokyo. Tokyo is marked by the very same ni. So we see the marker ni appearing in all the three functions. This is an example from Peter Sami. On the dative one, give one to Josh two. Josh is here. It has a dative marker J. And as in pretty much all the remaining Sami languages, the dative and the allative are marked the same. So also now one drives to Unvika by car. There's a J, the very same J on Unvika. Whereas Savo Creek is in the valley, we find the locative N on the valley, okay? So that's a case of a language where the dative is the same as the allative and the locative is different. Oh. Sorry, this is a language from an omotic language, Dime, or at least that's the way I pronounce it. It's spoken in Ethiopia. We see that the locative function, the child is in the house, a dog ran home. We find the very same marker, or we find a different marker for the dative. So we have a case where the allative is the same as the locative and they're different from the dative. What we do not find are languages like pseudo-English, which would be just like English, having a preposition in for the location, having a marker like to for the direction, for the allative, but then the dative marking would sort of fall back on the locative. Okay, so it would be a pattern like this. That is, instead of saying he gave the book to Mary, one would say he gave the book in Mary. Of course, in English, that's not what we find. In real English, we find an AAB pattern where the dative and the allative are the same to the exclusion of the locative. Okay. No. So this is the language sample that Blansit used for his generalization. And since I started working on the pattern, there's only one counter example that showed up in one of the Italian dialects investigated by Rita Mancini and Leonardo Savoia. There's a related study by Rice and Cabada who confirmed the finding, and so on the strength of this empirical record, I will simply try to explain not only why we do find certain overlaps, but also why we observe the facts shaped the way they are, and what that tells us about what the underlying composition of datives, allatives, and locatives. Now, I'll start, but what some people may consider to be the standard approach to syncretism, although the standard here should be really taken with a grain of salt. But what I basically mean is Jakobson's approach to capture case syncretism by decomposing cases into features. So I'll simply run you through Jakobson's proposal, and I'll show you what features he used to kind of explain syncretism in Russian. I'll show you how it works, how we get rules to compete, and then I will kind of lead the discussion showing why I think that the system has certain limitation when it comes to capturing generalizations like Clancy's, okay? And after we are done with the Jakobsonian approach, we'll put it to side and explore other alternatives, okay? But the point is first to see how it works and why I don't feel like walking down that road. So Jakobson, he ordered his cases in a table where the nominative, accusative, and genitive were on the first line of the table. Locative, dative, and instrumental were on the second line, and he observed that in Russian, all syncretisms pretty much neatly target contiguous regions within a table like this. And so, for example, an example that you see here is the adjective beautiful, which is in the plural syncretic between nominative and accusative, the genitive and locative, but has a difference between dative and instrumental. So Jakobson pretty much followed the same, or more like pioneered the approach to case syncretism in terms of shared meaning specifications. And so to account for the genitive and locative syncretism, he proposed that there was some kind of a meaning unit related to quantification. And he said that both of these cases, genitive and locative, were plus quantificational, whereas the other cases were minus quantificational. And so if then you went on to say that this marker ich is specified as pronouncing this shared element of meaning of quantification, then you will find it in these two environments and not in the others. Okay. Looking at the other syncretism, he proposed that there is, so we couldn't say, for example, to account for the nominative accusative syncretism, we couldn't say that the marker ie is just minus quantification. Even though they both occur in minus quantificational environments, that is not enough, okay? Because instrumental and dative are also minus quantificational. So he went on to add functions in a way to arrive at a satisfactory classification of the Russian case system, and he came up with these features plus peripheral versus minus peripheral, okay? So the nominative, accusative, and genitive were somehow central in the grammatical functions of the sentence, whereas the plus peripheral kind of expressed adjuncts and so on and so forth. And so that was his idea of what the feature minus peripheral would be doing. And then once we have the feature minus peripheral, we could actually say that IE basically reveals this shared meaning, which is both minus peripheral and minus quantificational. Okay, these two features are characteristic only for the nominative and accusative. In order to distinguish between the nominative and accusative, he ultimately also proposed a feature like plus directional and minus directional, where accusative and dative were characterized as plus directional, the accusative on the grounds that the action is aimed usually at the object, so it proceeds in the direction of the object. The dative marking recipients or goals in certain constructions would also be understood as plus directional, okay? Now, that's the basic idea of Jakobsonian system. The question then becomes how to capture syncretisms which are kind of nicely linearly adjacent in his table, occupying, for example, the locative and the dative. Yet there doesn't seem to be any feature that they share together. Okay, so we couldn't say that they were plus peripheral because the instrumental is also plus peripheral. Okay, and they differ in all other features than the peripheral. So this one is plus quantification, this one minus, this one is plus directional, this one minus. So they really share only the feature plus peripheral in a Jakobson system. Okay, so the question is really how to group them together. And one of the ideas that people proposed is that A really is just peripheral. And then in fact, it can also appear in principle in the instrumental case because it is a peripheral case, okay? It's just that in the instrumental, there is the marker OI, which is dedicated instrumental marker, okay, specified for all the meaning components of the instrumental, therefore creating, leading to some kind of a competition in the table. Okay, so these are later kind of developments of Jakobson's thinking throughout the syncretism literature. And because there is this competition between the A and the OI is more specific, it kind of outcompetes the A, so the A conveniently disappears. Okay, So that's the basic idea of a competition-based approach and how to use it to bring Jakobson's approach further to something like a descriptive success. Okay, and the reasoning which I now described to you has been formally implemented, for example, in the distributed morphology framework. Okay, so they have something they call the subset principle, which basically is nothing but a formal implementation of underspecification, which says that if a marker is specified as plus peripheral, okay, like the A in the last slide, it can appear in all the cells that have the plus peripheral and maybe even more. Okay, so the lexical item has to be a subset of the cells where it appears. And then there is the so-called elsewhere principle, going back to Kiparsky and ultimately to Sanskrit grammarians, which says that when you have competition, like in the instrumental, the more specific item wins. Okay, so that's the logic how people try to bring the approach further to capture the data at hand. So this kind of a implementation ultimately turns out to be, I think, a deadly fix. Okay, so it does fix something. It kind of brings the descriptive adequacy further, but at the cost of basically allowing anything to happen. And so I will now lead the discussion in a way to show you why this basically throws out any empirical content out of the theory. So this is a real paradigm of the numeral one, I believe. And you see that there is a syncretism in the kind of non-structural cases. So there are adna, adnu, and then in the remaining oblique cases, you find the form adnoi. Okay, so the question is, how do we capture that? And again, what we observe is that oi here appears both in minus peripheral, plus peripheral environments, minus directional, plus directional, minus quantificational, plus quantificational. So ultimately, the only thing we can say is that it appears basically, it can in principle appear in any cell pronouncing any case whatsoever for the particular numeral. Okay, there is no common denominator other than basically case. Okay, it's a case marker. And so in principle, it can appear in all the cases. And then you can sort of, you can further add the nominative marker A, which is minus directional, minus quantificational, minus peripheral, only nominative. Okay, so it's in competition in the nominative with OI, appears in the nominative. U plus directional, minus quantificational, minus peripheral, appears only in the accusative, and so it wins in competition, and the paradigm is satisfactorily accounted for using the tools we have introduced up to now. But as I told you, this was a deadly fix. So when in 1991, McRae and Hwani went on to discuss Russian syncretism, they pointed out that the Jakobson's table was very interesting object in terms of kind of bringing out certain restrictions on the syncretism. And they actually went even further. They said, you can sort of, you know, if you recall the table, okay, this is the nominative. And if you sort of just like straighten it out, the table, what you will get is a linear order of cases where nominative, accusative, genitive that used to be on the top line, you know, are here. Then the genitive still touches the locative, just like in the Jakobson's table. But then the dative and instrumental, okay, are kind of straightened out. So it's very similar to Jakobson. They are just not folded in the table. They are kind of open like this. And what they observe is that all the syncretisms in Russian can actually be confined to adjacent regions within a paradigm ordered in this particular way. And they use it as an argument against Jakobson because they say the Jakobsonian features basically fail to deliver any result that would be even remotely similar to this one. Why is that so? So what I did in 9, I just repeated the lexical entries for the morphemes that I showed you for the actual paradigm one, okay? And what I do now is I minimally modify it. So I still keep the lexical entry for OI, which just says, okay, you can be inserted in any case. I keep the entry for U, that was only accusative, and this one is also only accusative. And what I minimally change is just the specification for the A, which before just used to target specifically nominative. And so here, just for the purpose of the argument, I created it as a locative marker. So I just copied mechanically the feature that you would find in the locative case. Okay, so let us think what will happen when we have rules like this. Okay, there is nothing in the Jacobson's machinery as augmented by the later tradition that would prevent us from having a rule specification like that. What such a rule specification leads to is we have a general marker that appears in all cases but in the locative and in the accusative. That is, it appears in nominative. For the accusative, we have the U, then it appears in genitive. Does not appear in the locative because there we have the A, then we have the dative, and then the instrumental. Okay, and if you are kind of cunning enough, if you're smart enough, if you try to push it, press it, and you know, bend it around, you basically end up with the idea that if you have any underspecified entry like that, and you have four dedicated case markers, each for one particular case, then basically the conclusion is that any syncretism can be generated by this particular system. Okay, there is no natural way of bringing this system to deliver the restriction that McRae and Juani were interested about, or even the system that Jacobson himself was interested in. Okay? And so that was one of the observations that McRae and Juani brought to the literature. And their idea was that basically you kind of should drop a feature-based approach to syncretism altogether, and instead people should start following a geometric approach to case paradigms, where really in the mind of the speaker the paradigm is represented as a particular geometrically arranged object where markers occupy physical spaces in a way that disallows discontinuous storage of markers. Nevertheless, that's not the only conclusion possible, and in recent years there has been a surge, or in particular corners of the literature, in the interest of kind of linear contiguity patterns, which I'm calling here star ABA patterns, you know, because what star means that there's something disallowed, and what's disallowed is that two categories are syncretic and the third one in the middle is different. Okay, so the A means, that's the dative, that's the locative, and the allative in the middle is different, okay? And there was a general kind of a name for capturing linear restrictions on syncretism. Keep rolling it the other way around. Okay, so this is one of the approaches pioneered in a recent book by Jonathan Bobalik. And what he conducted was a typological study on some 300 plus languages, where he observed, building on previous work, that if the comparative degree of an adjective is suppletive, then the superlative degree is also suppletive with respect to the positive. What does that mean? Well, that means that if the positive has a shape A and the comparative is suppletive, has the shape B, okay, of the root, then the superlative is also suppletive with respect to the positive, so that is, it is not an A. So everything else should be allowed. So it is allowed that the root is the same for the positive, the comparative, and the superlative. It's also allowed that it's different for the positive and the same for the comparative and superlative. It should also, in principle, be possible that the positive and the comparative are the same and the superlative different. But what is not attested is this kind of an ABA type of pattern, okay, where the positive and the superlative have the same root to the exclusion of the comparative. And there are some kind of candidate counterexamples, and we can discuss them in the question period. So if you want to ask something, you can ask me, or you can go to Bobalik's book where he describes this in more detail. What's Bobalik's idea? Well, Bobalik's idea is depicted here. So what he says is that the positive basically corresponds to the basic meaning of the adjective. Okay? That's, for him, just an A for adjective. If you want to build a comparative, you have to put a comparative meaning to the adjective, which often gets pronounced by a separate marker, like in Czech. So starý, the positive, the root star, is augmented by š to express the comparative meaning. Okay? In the superlative, Bobalik proposes, the superlative basically means, so it's based on the comparative, which means smarter, and the superlative basically means than everyone else, okay? So the superlative has more meaning than the comparative, is based on it, and we can see that also in Czech that the comparative is fully contained in the superlative. Okay. How does that explain his ABA generalization? Why is it that this kind of a containment pattern is translated into a particular pattern of syncretism? The reasoning that Bobaly gives is like this. So he's assuming a realizational theory of morphology. That means you have the meaning, you first create the meaning, and then you're trying to pronounce it using lexical entries. The lexical entry for an adjective like good, for example, is going to be, okay, it's an adjective, just like many others. Then you have the suppletive root bet, which is going to be the pronunciation of the very same concept, but in the context of the comparative. Okay, so when the adjective is placed in the context of the comparative, you get bet. How is the adjective going to be pronounced in the superlative? Can it be pronounced good? Bobalik says no, because it's still in the context of the very same comparative. So whenever this comparative component triggers suppletion in the comparative, it will also do the same in the superlative. Okay? Notice that this is a different type of an organization of the meaning components of the morphological categories, whereas in the Jacobsonian world, that was plus minus, and everything was peripheral, quantificational, whatever you have, and plus minus. Okay, here, these features, these meaning components, are first of all privative, and second of all, they are what I would call cumulative. They kind of grow in number as you go. Okay. I will now briefly want to show you how adopting that idea will sort of lead on to deriving the absence of nonlinear syncretism or non-contiguous syncretism in case paradigms. So this is the gist of the idea. It's not a full picture, but this is the gist of the idea. The idea is that the nominative is basically a default form of a case. For example, people have noticed if you have hanging topics, you know, when there's something that doesn't force you to have a particular case, it's going to show up in nominative. When you have an accusative in the sentence, then people say, also in the functionalist literature, that basically accusative is just the reason for there being an accusative case marker is to distinguish the agent from the patient. So the appearance of the accusative is dependent on there being a hierarchically higher case marked noun. So it's a dependent case. Okay, it's dependent on the presence of something else in the structure. Then following the observation, okay, that accusatives and nominatives, you know, are often in kind of productive case shifting relations in the passive, and the genitives don't seem to be subject to the same kind of a willingness to change to nominative in sentences. People sometimes characterize that by saying they are oblique, and oblique means I don't participate in active-passive relations, in reflexives, and so on. I don't want to be part of this, okay? And there's very many ways of characterizing it, but the only thing I'm really interested in here is not motivating a particular proposal, but giving you the logic of how you can go on to capture it, okay? And the dative, the genitive tends to describe stative possession. Okay, the dative is a directional case, means the change of possession. So one could, for the sake of the argument, pretend that there's some kind of a directionality involved in the meaning of the dative. Okay, but what you see is that, unlike Jacobson, I have simply taken the spirit of Bobalik's analysis and applied it to case. Okay, my features are not binary, they're not plus minus. Okay, and they accumulate as I go down in the sequence of cases that McRae and Hwani brought to our attention. Okay? So here in 16, that's basically a different but basically an equivalent way of looking at the case system. Here I just say that the feature directional is characteristic only for the dative. Okay? The feature oblique is characteristic for the dative and the genitive. The feature dependent is characteristic for dative, genitive, accusative, and so on. Okay? And so the first observation is that if you have morphemes, that is case markers, which will feed on these features, they will, by necessity, only pick contiguous regions in the sequence nominative, accusative, genitive, dative. Okay? There is no single feature there that picks out a non-contiguous sequence. That's basically the point of 16. Now, remember how I kind of tried to show that the Jacobson system was not very well fitted to explain a linear restriction on syncretism. What I did was I sort of pretended there was a general case marker that could basically be the pronunciation of any case function. So I have that here. Okay, this is my alpha. I'm now here trying to kind of see whether this new system can also has the same flaw, to put it that way, as the Jacobson system. So it's a general case marker that can pronounce any case, nominative, accusative, genitive, dative. How do I create a non-contiguous pattern? I would now try to create a marker that is specific, for example, for the genitive. If I succeed to create a marker that's specific for the genitive, it will pronounce the genitive and create a non-contiguous syncretism between the accusative and the dative below it. Okay? So I try now to do a genitive marker. Remember, genitive has this specification, and so I say that this is my genitive marker, and the best thing I can do is to specify it as an oblique marker. Okay, that's the most specific feature that the genitive has. But it is not unique to the genitive. It is also characteristic for the dative. And so when I actually go on to generate my full paradigm, I have the marker alpha, which can appear in all cases, and then I have the marker beta, which can appear in genitive and dative. And so here it is more specific, you know, it applies in a proper subset of environments compared to alpha. And so my hands are tight. I cannot, with this system of decomposition, I cannot generate a non-contiguous syncretism. Okay, so that's what McRae and Hwani insisted we should try to do. Okay. So the observation that people have made following up on McRae and Hwani's work is that it's not really necessary, even if you have linear constraints on syncretism, it's not necessary to give up on features altogether. You can also have a more kind of a conservative proposal and say we still think that maybe syncretism reveals something about meaning, organization. Okay? It's just that the meaning of organization has to be of this type. The categories have privative meaning elements and they accumulate in the direction, in the hierarchy or in the linear constraint that we observe. And there has been a surge of work that sort of looked at various contiguity restrictions for participles and verb forms in general, for locatives and directionals, for negation, for WH pronouns, for demonstratives, whatever you have, and people have been proposing this type of an approach of decomposition. Now, if I were now to sort of take the lesson, you know, that these people have proposed, and I try to use it to explain my data, it's not gonna go good, okay? So, but I will first show you why it doesn't go good, and then I propose a new type of explanation for Blunt's generalization. Okay, so I've got two logical options. What are they? First, remember Blunt's generalization is the dative is the same as the allative, and when the dative is the same as the locative, then the allative also has to be the same. Okay, so how do I do this? Well, I can say that the dative has the smallest number of features, and whatever its meaning is, let me suppose that just like with the adjective, this is the meaning of the dative. Then I will say you have to add some component of meaning to the dative so that you get the allative, and then I will later think about what that component of meaning is going to mean, so that when I combine it with the contribution of the dative, I will get the meaning of the allative. And then I will take the allative and add a component of meaning to get the locative. Okay, so I maintain kind of mechanically the same type of organization. And then I will ask later what these features mean. There's a second option. Namely, I will say that the locative is the simplest, whereas before I said it was the allative, now I say it's the locative. The allative is built on the basis of the locative by adding some element of meaning, and the dative is built from the allative. Okay, which of them is correct? Well, I have to go, and just like Bobalik looked at the containment of comparatives and superlatives, I will now go into languages and see which one of them tends to contain the others. And we will see there's surprises coming up. one surprise is already in Blansi's work. So he says that when you look at Tigrinya, which is an Afro-Asiatic language spoken in north of Africa, when you look at the marking of dative is ne, when you look at the locative is ab, and the allative is nab. He took that to mean that the allative was actually the combination of ne and ab. And it was the most complex of the morphology. Okay? But this was the single case that he had. And moreover, there's this phonological bump in the way. So he wasn't really sure whether this is the containment pattern. But his idea was, you know, if the markers really have a contiguous distribution in the sequence that he proposed, okay, then the distribution of ab is, it marks the allative, the locative. The ne marks the dative and the allative, and here they overlap, and so you get both of them at the same time. Okay, that was his idea. But he said the evidence was very scarce. And so I went further, and I looked at some other languages. And so this is Macedonian. Macedonian, you know very well, has lost cases, so the dative function now these days is expressed by the preposition na. Okay? The locative, I am at the park, is expressed by kai. And when you say to someone, I'm going to the park, you combine the dative followed by the locative followed by the park. Exactly like in Tigrinya. Okay? The dative comes on top of the locative, comes on top of the park. This is very productive in Macedonian. All the locative prepositions work like this. This is the mirror image pattern. It comes from Varis, which is a language spoken in the Papua New Guinea. Here you have the dative marker. He just gave me a book, so you have this M on a pronoun. Here you see the locative. The locative has two different markers, ra and ina, depending on whether the location is inanimate house or animate eye. Okay? When it comes to expressing the goal of motion, you start from the locative with the ra, and the dative appears after it. Okay, so first the locative, then the dative. The same when you have an animate location, it takes the animate allomorph and then the dative. Okay, so it's very unlikely that this ram and inam are complex markers, because the ra and ina part, they track the original animacy, non-animacy distinction, and the ma, the dative, comes after that. This is Malayalam, that's a Dravidian language spoken southeast India. The dative is expressed by ka, the locative by il, and just like in Varis, the allative is formed by stacking the dative on top of an augmented version of the locative. Okay, there are some reasons to think that this il and this il are the same, the e is a separate marker, which we can talk about more in the discussion period, but I won't go into this. This is a Caucasian language, Cez, as famously described by Bernard Comrie and Maria Polinsky in their 1998 paper. And what they point out is that Cez, just like Caucasian languages in general, has a big set of so-called orientation markers. These are suffixes expressing location. So when you take a noun, and you put the a suffix, that means in. When you put this lambda, that means among. But when you want to express a motion to that direction, what you do is you take the very same orientation marker and you put an r in a position following. Okay? And they are very clear about that this r, there are reasons to think that that's actually the dative marker. Okay? So in Cez, in Varis, in Malayalam, it's the same pattern over and over again. Here, this is again a Papuan language, Yatmul, and here the pattern is slightly different. Again, what we see is that the allative is composed of the locative and the dative, but they are in the different order. Whereas before, we always had the locative closer to the noun. Okay, we started from the locative, and then we added the dative, kind of in a more peripheral position. Here we have the dative closer to the noun and the locative. Okay, but what does that mean? It means that the allative, no matter which language you look at, and there's quite a few of them, tends to be composed of the dative and the locative. And we found various orders. We found the order dative, locative, noun in Tigrinyan Macedonian. We found the mirror image order with the locative closer to the noun in Malayalam, Varis, and Cez. And we found the different order in the Atmur, but what they all share is that the Alatur is composed of the basic envelope. And that, because the Blunt's generalization is dative, allative, locative, and the allative is in the middle, it cannot be that I am growing my features, you know, as I go left to right or right to left. The allative, which is in the middle, apparently is the most complex morphology. So how do I do this? How can we model the meaning? How can we model the restrictions? How can we model the composition of the morphemes? Okay, what's the story? The story is gonna be very simple. I'm simply gonna really start from the table that we've already seen from Tigrinya. And we have had the marker ab for the allative and locative. And I will simply add to Blunt's description that ab expresses the meaning a, whatever that meaning happens to be. And that I have a marker ne, which expresses a meaning b, whatever that meaning happens to be, and the allative has both of the meanings. So I will propose that the dative is characterized by some abstract meaning b, the locative by a, and the allative by ab. What is ab? When you look into the literature on locatives, and here I think the consensus is more, is kind of relatively broad across various range of approaches, the idea is that when you have a locative, you start from the noun like a table, okay, and you create a location based on where the table is. It's either in the interior of the table, under, above, or something. But that's what you do. You take the noun, and you create a location based on the noun. Okay? What's the meaning of the allative? The meaning of the allative is that you take the locative, that is the location in the table, or under the table, or above the table, and you construe a trajectory that starts somewhere and leads to that location. Okay, so compositionally, when people want to describe motion in space, they always start from location, like here, like in the table, and you construe a trajectory that starts from outside that location and leads to that location. Okay, people also do that from the sources. If you have a location in the table and you make, have a source expression, you start at that location and you go out. Okay, so this is very, very traditional. And now the only new thing really here is that, as I proposed, I will take it that the meaning that creates the allative on the basis of the locative, the path, the trajectory, is really the same thing as the dative. That's what the languages seem to tell us case after case after case. And so what is the meaning of this going to be? So I told you that the meaning of this dative is that it creates a trajectory leading to this location. Okay, so here I take the same meaning as a trajectory. Something is following that trajectory, but it's leading to an individual. Okay? And that's pretty much very close to what people say the meaning of recipient is. You have a book and it's undergoing a change of possession. It's following a trajectory from someone else and then it's with a different individual. Okay? And so the idea is that the composition of the meaning that we see in various languages reflects this type of organization of the meaning, okay? The locative simply turns a noun into a location, and the allative adds a trajectory that leads to that location. And the dative simply denotes a trajectory that ends with an individual, ending up in the possession between the individual and whatever undergoes that movement on the trajectory. That also explains the way the markers in the complex languages tend to come ordered, you know. So we've noticed that in Macedonian, we always had the locative marker closer to the noun than the allative marker. Okay, if we assume that the meaning is unstructured, that it's simply A, B, whatever, combined it together somehow, okay, that asymmetry in the ordering would not be captured. What we seem to be finding more often than not is that the locative first combines with the noun, the allative, the dative, comes later. In the mirror image languages like Vari, Siatmur, Malayalam, is the same organization, just the ordering is different. But still, you first turn the noun into a location, and then you add the dative on top of that, leading to a trajectory ending up at that location. There's slightly involved story about what are we going to say about languages like Yatmul, where the markers come in the other order. Okay, And there is an approach going back to Cinque 2005, where he looked at Greenberg's universal 20. Greenberg universal 20 pertains to the ordering of modifiers of the noun. For example, the demonstrative precedes the adjective, precedes the noun. Okay? So when you have the order demonstrative adjective noun, it's always that the demonstrative precedes the adjective, precedes the noun, and never the adjective precedes the demonstrative, precedes the noun. Okay? Before the noun, you only have one order, and it's the one which is kind of nicely scopal, reflects the ordering of the operations. But when you look at cross languages and you look into the post-nominal position, there's weird things happening. You get counter-scopal orders. What you want semantically is that the locative applies first and the directional after, okay? But the ordering is different. And the way he proposed to account for it is that you have to move the noun sort of to a slightly different position so that interpretation-wise, this is scopal, but in the surface, the location of the noun is not. And there is a whole literature on how you want to do it and why you want to do it, but I'll simply assume that this is somewhere close to correct, okay? That the meaning structure is always the same, it's just that the noun has the tendency to run away. Thereby explaining the asymmetry where before the noun you always find the scopal orders, whereas after the noun you find the scopal and the counterscopal order. The reason for the counterscopal order is because the noun can run away. So now the question is, how can we use this new finding to explain the syncretism pattern? I will start by simply asking the question, what are we going to do with languages which have a simple allative marker, okay? I'll be treating simple allative markers as portmanteaus. What is a portmanteau morpheme? Portmanteau morpheme is such a morpheme that pronounces more features inside itself, okay? So for example, when you look at the English, he walks, so there is a S at the end, and it expresses person, third person, and singular. It expresses two categories at once. I will take markers like this, allative ra, to be precisely of the same type of portmanteau morpheme. Namely, I will understand it as a type of a morpheme that inside it expresses both the B and A features. Okay? So the idea for languages like Basque is that they are exactly the same, like Yatmul, which is the weird language with the counterscopal order, where you take the noun away from the two features, B and A, which remain in the scopal order, but the noun is to the left. And the only difference between Basque and languages like Yatmul is that in Yatmul, the allative marker, ra, is actually the pronunciation of both of these features. Okay? And notice that the way I did it here, and I will not be really leading you through the technicalities, is I'm assuming that there is a nesting structure, there is an order in which you have to apply the meaning components. It's just the morphology pronounces them at a single time, okay? And I will not be elaborating on that very much. I will just simply go back to the idea that the locative corresponds to the location, the dative corresponds to a path, and the allative corresponds to a path leading to a location. And I will now show you how the Blanc's generalization follows, and then I am done, okay? And we'll be right on time. So I will again take the idea, which I already mentioned, that you build the meaning representation first, and your lexical entries simply pronounce that representation, okay? So there is a meaning representation corresponding to these features, A for the locative, that's the location, B for the dative, that's the path, and this is the path to a location, that's the allative. And so if you have a language which has a lexical entry for each of these markers, you will end up with a language where every function has its own marker. And so as I told you, I'll be using the over-specification approach. So when I have a dative marker specified as B, it will appear in all the cells it contains. So it only contains B, so it can only pronounce this cell. Okay, so I mark it by this dark shading. This is where it applies. If I have the locative marker that pronounces the meaning component A, it can appear only in the locative. Okay, it does not contain the allative. Because it does not contain B, it cannot apply in the dative and the allative. Always the other way around. And the allative marker will be specified for both of the meaning components. And remember, because I have an over-specification approach, I allow a lexical item like the allative to pronounce any case or any meaning that's contained inside it. So because it contains B, it can pronounce the dative, it can pronounce the allative because it contains AB, can pronounce the locative because it contains A. Okay, so I just mark the applicability by this gray shading. And now we do the competition, and you can easily see that here the locative is going to be more specific, so the locative marker here wins. Okay, and you get a language where there is no syncretism. The other languages which do have syncretism will always have this allative marker, but will lack one or the other or both. Okay, so let me just show that to you. So this is Japanese. Japanese, I've shown you, has just a single marker for all of them. Okay? So it will have the marker ni, which lexically will be specified in exactly the same way as the Basque allative. It will simply lack the competitors. And because it has no competitors, and it contains all the relevant cells of the paradigm in its meaning specification, you will just only see the ni. Now comes the Pitesami. So Pitesami has a marker J, Y, which is syncretic between the allative and the dative. Okay? So what the model of the language will be like is that, again, it has the allative marker, which is a multipurpose marker. It contains all the meanings. In principle, can pronounce all the functions. But it has a competitor in the locative, which is N. And so in Pitesami, ultimately what you have is the multipurpose marker surfacing only in the dative and the allative, but not in the locative. Okay. So that's the result. Now this is the Cushitic language, Daim. It has a marker O, which has the allative function and the locative function. Because it has the allative function, I'm proposing it can pronounce both of the meaning elements. So because it's specified for both of them, it can appear anywhere. And it has a dedicated competitor for the dative, the marker in. And as a result of the competition here, this one is gonna be more specific, but otherwise the so-called elsewhere marker will surface and you get the following pattern of syncretism. And the last thing I'll show you before I call it a day is that you cannot generate with this type of meaning organization, it's impossible to generate the violating pattern where the dative and the locative would be the same to the exclusion of the allative. Okay, how would I generate that pattern? Okay, I would again be this kind of a, you know, vicious guy who tries to make it difficult. So I will have this kind of a marker that's specified as A and B, and I just said because it contains the B meaning, it can pronounce B, it contains the A meaning, so it can pronounce A. And then I will create a competing marker, B, that's gonna be specified as the allative only. And the result of this competition, the way I set it up, is here, this guy is more specific, so it's gonna be here, and the A in the remaining cells. Okay, that's how I'm trying to set it up. So what is going to be the meaning specification for B? Remember, it can pronounce the allative, so it has to contain all the meaning components of the allative so that it is a superset of it. So the only specification that I can come up with, okay, so this is what I just told you, the only to derive that paradigm as hard as I could, and I figure out that I can't with the meaning components I set up and with this kind of over-specification approach in my bag. And so that's the good result, okay? That's how I show you that when you adopt this meaning specification, it's not only that the containment falls into place, but also Blunt's generalization is derived from the idea that that's the meaning components. And so here I just scroll forwards through an anticlimax to faint.
Thank you very much for your talk. Okay, I open the discussion. So I think that you presented very nice ways how to describe syncretism, morphological syncretism, fitting for all or for general in linguistics. So I have one question. What has happened with instrumental? The first question. And the second is, you chose Jakobson's representation of the syncretism using the binary opposition. And why did you know the another representation given by Jakobson in the form of the cube?
Yes.
But how did you? I suppose or I guess that you chose this representation because this cube representation fits only for Russian cases. Is it true or not?
So I will start with the Jakobson answer and then I go to the instrumental. Okay, that is two little questions. I am not a Jakobson expert, so I don't want to make any strong claims here. But to the extent that I did go back to these papers and I tried to read them, I actually think that his kind of geometric approach or the cube approach and the feature-based one, I think that they're basically equivalent. That is, yeah. One can be translated into the other.
Right, they are equivalent.
It's just that I think that in the end, I think that one way of how to read what I presented here, which is actually not exactly my verb, but I mean people have been pointing that out before me, like McCarrick and Juan in particular, is that the cube approach, basically on their worldview, should be reified. That should be the model of the lexical storage, is the cube, and the lexical items basically occupy edges of the cube, right? So their conclusion was that the feature representation, forget about them, that was a step in the wrong direction, they are not equivalent, they are something very different, the spatial one is correct, and the feature-based one is incorrect. So that's one thing. The second thing is, how does the Jakobson approach compare to other languages? So that's a very controversial thing to say, and there's been a lot of work on it, and this kind of back and forth. So I think that, to be honest, the Jakobson approach, or the findings that we have, you know, and even the McRae-Kwani approach, and it's like the linear order paradigm, that's actually quite good for a very significant number of languages. So I figured out that I was interested in it, is that already Sanskrit grammarians, already the paradigm is not working already for Sanskrit, so that all the homophony simply that you find in Sanskrit fit a linear order. You can do the same for a lot of languages, but in all of languages it fails. And for languages where this fails, there is a debate. And the debate takes the following form. So how strong are
covers maybe
of money.
Like the cost of our ambition, this Y in the nominative plural, like Arabic, and then in the accusative plural and in the instrumental plural. And the instrumental being syncretic is known as an accusative, is very, very relative. And so the question is, you know, how seriously shall we take this country? So there will be a
debate, and I don't. On the instrumental, so I just basically put it away for reasons of being short, or like brevity, you know, just to explain the logic. But there is an interesting kind of a correlation which does not show up in Czech, but it does show up in a lot of languages outside of the Slavic speaking area. In fact, to the extent that, for example, in the Austronesian language family, there is a very frequent syncretism, and also in Caucasian languages, between instrumental and source. So, like, he jumped out of the box, or he, you know, ran out from under the table, or something like that. And the way that people, even like writing descriptive grammars of these languages, try to explain that. So the way they try to look at it is that the instrumental being a marker for instruments, they see the instruments as a kind of a source of the event, you know, in a metaphorical way. So there is some kind of a figure-ground relationship between them, such that the instrument is the source of the event. Whereas with the source marking, right, it's the location which is a source of motion. And so that's the way they're trying to bring them together. And it's actually, I think, an interesting idea to follow, because also, I mean, we know in Latin the ablative used to be the same as the instrumental, right? Or the instrument was the same as the ablative in Latin. So also in Indo-European we find vestiges of it. And so that's the first kind of part of a story. So the instrument, cross-linguistically instrumental, has the tendency to express source, okay? So how does that now relate to the dative? Well, the dative denotes the direction somewhere, okay, and the instrumental kind of the opposite one. And so there have been people saying that actually sources tend to be, again, morphologically more complex than goals, and there's kind of a general cognitive bias for interpreting things as goal of sources, that the source is actually a reversed path compared to the directional. So the direction two, like on the table, goes like this. And the from the table is a reversed path. So it actually contains the two paths, but the reverse. So that's kind of a complicated answer to your question. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, maybe I'm asking about the same thing. So I was wondering about prepositions such as onto, into, from behind, maybe in Czech, spoza, and also in German, you have these adverbial particles like heraus, hinein. There is probably no syncretism here, right? But have you ever looked into this? Is there anything interesting to say?
So I will start by again saying I did try to look at it. It's a can of worms, as everything, so one has to be careful. Nevertheless, there are some interesting generalizations emerging, okay? And so, for example, if I would, just to start with Czech, okay, how would I fit Czech to the general dative-allative pattern, okay? So I think that if there is any vestige or trace of this kind of a general cross-linguistic pattern in Czech, it would be the prepositional phrase like k domu, ke Karlovi, whatever you have there, the preposition k kind of, you know, is what differentiates between the dative and the allative, right? So we have seen lots of languages where allatives are based on datives, and the Czech pattern seems to be actually an expected mutation of that pattern. Okay, so that's the first thing. So I would tend to take this seriously. Okay, now, given or assuming that I would have something like I don't know if you'll be able to see this, but so okay. Right, so that's the dative, and this is whatever brings the dative to the allative. Okay. Now, how does that gonna go with the z? Right, even starting with the simple one. Okay, there's gonna be again two components of the source. Z, or let's say z is simple, right? So we have the genitive here, and we have the from here. And already here, it's kind of very tricky, you know, because it already here, at least, I have some kind of a basis. I'm thinking, okay, so this is the dative, and that's the part, okay? But here, it looks like I have a genitive, and I'm not exactly sure what the genitive corresponds to. Okay, here I have a z, which on its own seem to express something like from in. And so I am not very sure how to do this, really. Nevertheless, there is a correlation between the genitive and the source. And it sometimes shows up in languages in a clearer form than in Czech. In Czech, I really don't know which end to start pulling it from and start decomposing. And I think one of the clearest cases is in classical Greek, where you have some prepositions like para, which means at. And the pattern is a bit like this. When you have para, and then you have the noun, and then you have a genitive, so that means from. Okay? And the reason why it's simpler is because when you have this same preposition with a dative, it means at. And when you have the same preposition with an accusative, it means to. Okay? And the reason why it's different is because in Greek, when you observe this pattern in full, for some preposition you find it in full, in some prepositions, you know, there's a lot of... So this part here seems to be invariant and seems to correspond to the location, you know, to the particular configuration that you have. It means at. And this basically codes the distinction between stationary to from. Okay, so the prepositions themselves have nothing to do with encoding direction, stationary location, or source. It's the case markers which do it. And so in the type of representations that I have been using, that kind of leads to a very kind of a paradoxical structure. It's paradoxical from the perspective of morphology, because the semantic interpretation you would expect is you have the preposition, par, combining with the noun, denoting a particular configuration between the object and another one. Okay, and so this is the location. And the case marker, the difference between the, let's say, accusative and the genitive, codes the path, the type of path that is traversed with respect to that location. Okay, so this is the old observation by the Indo-Europeanists that the case markers correspond to, you know, notions like stationary at place, at rest, movement to, movement from. And the preposition takes no part in that. You know, it just gives you the particular configuration. But it's, of course, paradoxical from the sense that here the preposition and the noun form a tighter semantic unit than the noun and the case marker. So it's very difficult. You know, it's very difficult to touch it. But this contrast is real. So there are people like Jost Zwart. He's one of, like, famous people in semantics of spatial expressions. And he does also computer implementations, and he says these are real problems for compositional semantics. You know, because he says my compositional semantics must work like this, I cannot do it in any other way, yet this is a problem for morphology, so it's very difficult. But thank you for the, but yes, this idea that the genitive, you know, corresponds to source, That's very frequent across languages. Sinhala has it. You know, lots of languages have it beyond Indo-European. Already Greek is complicated and Czech is complicated double, because all of a sudden, where Greek had invariant par, you have the Z, which also codes the source, right? The Z is always source. And so it looks like the source is coded twice, and it gets very easily unmanageable to me. But thank you for asking. It's an interesting question. I don't know whether I answered half of it, but.
I actually asked about something slightly different, but this was even more interesting.
Thank you for a nice discussion. Maybe I could offer a crazy hypothesis for the genitive issue. Because actually in Czech you don't only have z něčeho, you also have do něčeho, which is quite the opposite direction semantically. And I think there are languages, I believe it happens in Hindi and somewhere else, where you have compound prepositions, which essentially mean something like from inside of something or to inside of something and so on. So is it possible that, and then you would actually have genitive, the of something would be a genitive encoded. Is it possible that thousands of years ago there was something like that in Indo-European and then the middle part, the noun, disappeared?
Questions? Okay, so once again, thank you for the discussion part, which was very rich as well. So thank you once more.
Thank you very much. Thank you.